This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. An uneasy quiet appears to have settled over Tibet nearly 3 weeks after the worst outbreak of violence there in almost two decades. Accounts differ on the numbers of people killed in the protests, from as many as 140, according to Tibet's government in exile, to as few as 19 by China's count. Hundreds others are under arrest, except for a brief visit last week. Foreign journalists have not been allowed to enter Tibet. Chinese officials in Beijing blame Tibet's spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, for inciting the unrest, a charge he denies. The Dalai Lama is not just the spiritual leader of Tibet. He's also involved in politics as the head of the Tibetan government in exile based in Dharamsala in northern India. As a Buddhist, the Dalai Lama advocates nonviolence. His policy, which he calls the middle way, argues for Tibetan autonomy, not independence, and he's not called for a boycott of the Beijing Olympic Games. Some younger Tibetans reject the middle way as too slow and ineffectual. Later in the program, the carbon footprint of the Earth Hour. But first, the Dalai Lama. If you have questions about his life, his ideas, his leadership, and his political dilemma, give us a call. 800-989-8255 is the phone number. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Our guest today is journalist Pico Iyer. He's known the current Dalai Lama for 34 years. His new book is called The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama, and he joins us today from the studios of Sports Byline in San Francisco. And it's nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation today.
Very nice to be here.
And tell us a little bit more about the middle way. What is it?
The phrase itself comes from the Buddha, and just as it sounds, it's about avoiding extremes in every form, so that when you're confronted with a challenge, you don't punch back, but nor do you just turn your back to your aggressor. You try constantly to find the common place and to speak to him rather than lash out at him. But of course, the drawback of the middle way is that if you're in the middle of any contest, you're getting attacked and challenged from every side.
And indeed, the critics of the middle way might argue that despite the wonderful spiritual creature that the Dalai Lama is, his policies, the middle way, have produced not a lot of results in the past 50 years.
Yes, and I think characteristically, the Dalai Lama himself would be the first person to say that. In fact, I remember I was talking to him about 12 years ago in his house in Dharamsala, and he said, well, yes, if you look at it in a certain way, from a certain angle, I've been extending the hand of friendship and forbearance to Beijing for 40 years, and the only result is that Beijing is coming down on Tibet harder and harder. And I said, well, what would you counsel your people there? And he said, more patience. And that was 12 years ago. And as we've all seen in recent weeks, I think the level of impatience among other Tibetans is growing and growing. At the same time, as having spoken to the Dalai Lama about this for 34 years, I'm convinced that he's probably the most realistic political leader I've met in my life as a journalist.
And why do you say that?
Because he approaches everything very scientifically. He tries almost to look at the world through a magnifying glass and to look at reality first and then to see what he can do with it. I think he often might refer to himself as a doctor of the mind or of the Tibetan situation. And a doctor's mandate, of course, is not to bring his own ideas, not even to bring his own spiritual ideas to something, but just to assess something accurately, a situation accurately, to come up with a diagnosis and then to suggest a useful cure. And of course, he's been doing that with the Chinese for 50 years now.
Does realism, though, lend toward, pessimism? Hey, there's no way this is going to happen.
No, but I think it does lead to a very long-term picture, and I think that's what we're seeing right now, which is that many young Tibetans especially feel, just as we might feel in such a situation, how can we sit by and do nothing, as he's counseling us to do, while our whole country is wiped off the map? We've got to act now. And he says, well, you've got to look to the next century. And one of the forms that realism takes is being aware that the majority of people in the Tibetan capital of Lhasa now are, in fact, Chinese. So regardless of what's done with Tibetan individuals, they are living currently and probably in the foreseeable future in an area which is predominantly Han Chinese. And so there's no magic solution that's going to come from the skies. And I think, again, one of the things we sometimes forget is that he has been dealing with the Chinese for 58 years now. He was up against Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai and Deng Xiaoping even in the 50s, and he traveled across the whole of China for a year in 1954. So in some ways, I think he's keenly attuned, as anyone would be in such a situation, to matters of face, of Chinese pride, of how best to work with the Chinese without just bringing down an even more relentless crackdown on their part. And of course, he's leading a people who up against a force that's 200 times more populous than his own. There are 6 million Tibetans and there are 1.2 billion Chinese. And so resistance really is only going to bring more suffering to people who've suffered so much already. That's to say, the Tibetans in occupied Tibet.
Yet you mentioned the demographic changes in Tibet, that two-thirds of the population of Lhasa, the capital, are now Han Chinese. A high-speed train in from the country brings, I think it's something like 6,000 new Han Chinese into that city every day. Again, a Tibetan might say, it's very well to counsel patience, but my country is being taken away from me. If I wait too long, there will be nothing left.
Exactly so. And in fact, the Dalai Lama himself uses the term demographic aggression to refer to the flooding of Han Chinese into Tibet. But I think his first impulse is never to think of the Han Chinese as one disembodied group of abstraction. He sees them as individuals. And for example, one of the things from which he derives hope is that more and more Chinese individuals are turning to Tibet, turning even to Tibetan Buddhism. And I think, to me, the most startling event in recent weeks came about 10 days ago when 29 Chinese leading writers and intellectuals risked their lives, just as the Tibetans have been doing, by petitioning the government in Beijing and saying, please talk to the Dalai Lama, please stop suppression in Tibet, please bring in an investigating inquiry. And of course, we'd expect the Tibetans to do that, but here it is, Chinese individuals putting themselves on the line on behalf of the Tibetans. And I've been to Lhasa many times since 1985, and what I notice each time I go there, it's more and more Chinese city. But on the other hand, each time I go there, more and more Chinese individuals, perhaps because of this long-term vacancy in their whole 50 years of in their heart, 50 years of mandated atheism, are in fact seeking out Tibetan Buddhist teachers, making offerings at the central temple, even practicing Tibetan Buddhism.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. Our guest is Pico Iyer, the author of The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. We'll begin with Martin. Martin with us from Santa Clara in California.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. It was a really interesting topic. My question was, with the advent of the Internet, and I don't know what kind of access there is in Tibet, but has that changed the views and the values of the younger generation coming up? Are they becoming more capitalist? Have they started to question the religion that they're in? Has it really created a situation where it's becoming more and more difficult to not necessarily control them, but to have them all aligned in a single focus?
That's a wonderful question, and I think many Tibetans in Tibet who've only known Chinese leadership probably are becoming much more materialistic. They're almost discouraged from learning or speaking Tibetan. They've never seen their leader, the Dalai Lama. They're told not to practice their religion or to enjoy their culture. And inevitably, after 50 years of this, they are further and further from their own tradition. And yet, at the same time, every time I've been back, I've found, and again, it's a natural human impulse, that the more pressure is brought on them, at some level, the more they hold out for their Tibetanness. And certainly, I think, remain very unswervingly devoted to the Dalai Lama, because he's the one great symbol of an independent Tibet. And they realize, I think, that he's the one asset that the Tibetans have that many other freedom movements around the world don't have. But you're absolutely right that living in a Chinese city, many Tibetans probably would think of themselves almost as not so different from their Chinese neighbors. It's interesting, the Dalai Lama himself wrote an introduction to a book on the Internet a few years ago, because for him, the Internet and all our global communications actually speak for connectedness and the fact that you can't solve a problem in any one place without taking into account all the other places. And I think that's, again, part of what he's suggesting in his sense of a much larger picture, and that you can't correct Tibet without taking into account the needs of China. And everywhere else, of course.
It's also interesting, Martin, read this morning in the newspaper, Tibetan police are sending text messages to residents' cell phones to tell them to either stay inside or come and turn themselves into police. Again, I guess new technology has a lot of unanticipated effects.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thanks very much for the call. And Pico Iyer, obviously the internet is not only the only boon that the Chinese have brought to Tibet. There have been better transportation, better telephone communications, a lot of physical improvements. Electricity has become much more widespread. Prosperity is beginning to spread into the Tibetan plateau.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things that often surprises me as a hardened longtime journalist is that when I speak to the Dalai Lama, he's probably one of the first people to say exactly what you said, which is that Tibet traditionally has been a poor and materially backward place, and that Tibet, the Chinese have indeed brought great improvements. I mean, it's striking to many people that he's one of those people who isn't necessarily against the high-speed train that was introduced two summers ago, and who always stresses that if it's used compassionately or genuinely with Tibetan needs in mind, it can be a great, great boon in bringing even more prosperity to a country that has always been very cut off from the world. And again, I think 15 years ago, he said to me very forcibly, the worst mistake we made ever in Tibet, our greatest mistake, was being too isolated from the world. It goes back to the internet. The more connection we have with the outside world and even with China, the better things are going to be in the long run. And I think what he's proposing to his people, which again is humanly very difficult to accept, is to be 100% in favor of Tibet and Tibetan rights without ever being against China, or without ever forgetting all the Chinese individuals who have, you know, the same rights and who are also suffering under a very difficult government.
And we'll get to that very interesting question of the Chinese and who's enemy. But nevertheless, quickly, is there any resentment that at the time the Tibetan people are suffering inside and outside Tibet, the Dalai Lama occasionally is seen, getting congressional medals here in Washington, D.C., or hobnobbing with Hollywood movie stars?
No, I think the Tibetans realize that he's going to Washington and he's trying to awaken the conscience of the world to the Tibetan predicament is, in fact, their one great hope. So I think there's no resentment there. I think the only point of pressure is that some Tibetans will say, and we can understand this, well, he is a very elevated monk, so of course it's easy for him to talk about patience and forbearance and to practice it. But we're struggling human beings, and it's very, very difficult for us to hold to this high moral course that he's suggesting.
We're talking.
But I think they're aware that those movie stars and many people in the U.S. have been among the great champions and supporters of Tibet.
We're talking with Pico Iyer about the Dalai Lama. Amid protests, what are the prospects that Tibet could achieve autonomy? I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about recent protests in Tibet and about the Dalai Lama. A little background on the 14th Dalai Lama. He is both the spiritual and the political leader of Tibet. He is 72 years old, born in northeastern Tibet. When he was 2 years old, he was recognized as the reincarnation of the 13th Dalai Lama. Since 1959, he's lived in exile in Dharamsala, India. As you might recall, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1989. He now faces criticism from some Tibetans as too modern, from others as too traditional, while China calls him a terrorist. Pico Iyer is with us. He's known the Dalai Lama for more than 30 years. His new book is called The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama. If you have questions about his life, his ideas, his leadership, and his political problems, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And you can check out what other readers, listeners are having to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Let's see if we can get another caller in. This is Chris. Chris calling us from San Francisco.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well, thank you.
Hey, I was just wondering if your guest could outline like the specific grievances that China has against the Dalai Lama, because I always hear such like awesome things about him, and I've learned lots of great stuff from his speeches, but they always call him a terrorist and stuff. I don't really understand it.
Okay, Pico Iyer, what's China's problem with the Dalai Lama?
That's a great question, and really I think they have no legitimate grievance. So all they do is try to insult him and use him as a figurehead for everything that they dislike or think is outdated in Tibet. And it's often funny. Last week, I think 2 weeks ago, they called him a splitist, which is funny because mostly what he talks about is interdependence and connectedness. They called him an enemy of the Tibetan people, and I think most of us are aware that he's working day and night to help the Tibetan people. They even called him a jackal in a monk's robes and an evil spirit 2 weeks ago, and he's calling them a friend. So it is quite a contrast. And I think one reason for their nervousness is that they know that there's no no case that can be brought against him, that he is somebody who's widely admired and respected around the world. And so they don't know what to say, and they flail around and just throw anything they can at him. And it's curious, too, that they say that he was guilty of inciting the riots, because what we've seen, even from here in San Francisco, where I'm sitting, is that he's been trying very hard to suppress the riots and tell his people, please don't make violent attacks against the Chinese.
That's a splittist, that odd use of that word. But nevertheless, the charge then would be that he wants to split Tibet off from China.
Yeah,
yes, which
seems like this idea of an autonomous China without, or an autonomous Tibet without splitting off of China is a pretty good middle road, like you're saying. I think the middle road's a great idea.
I think you're absolutely right. And it's interesting, he's probably the least of a splittist of all the Tibetans, because many other Tibetans, of course, do call for full independence and want to have nothing to do with China. And he, for 21 years, has been making these concessions and say, no, we need China, and China's brought us many things, and our destinies are intertwined. So China should control Tibet's defense matters and its foreign affairs, but please, can we Tibetans just have control over our own lives and have basic freedoms that most people have?
And Chris, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
But doesn't that position seem like a real compromise on principle? It seems to be accepting the fact, well, they outnumber us by a whole lot. We're not going to win on that, so let's take what we can get.
Well, I would say it goes back to the realism that I was mentioning before. But certainly, he's in an interesting position as church and state in one. And so when he took that position in 1987, indeed, some people said, well, you're much too trusting and unworldly, you're much too much of a monk. And others said just what you said, which is, this is much too strategic and you're much too political a figure. And so I think anyone, any individual, and he is a human being, would find it hard to juggle these two roles that seem to belong to different spheres. But I'm often struck when I talk to him that he's operating in a way that politically is very hard for us to follow, but in fact speaks for this great radicalism. I remember 5 years ago, I think, I was talking to him in Dharamsala, and he said, well, maybe in 30 years, Tibet will be 6 million Tibetans and 10 million Chinese Buddhists. And if that's the case, well, maybe something will be okay. And at that time, I thought, well, that sounds very quixotic or unrealistic. The last time I traveled with him, which was in November, I spent a week with him going across Japan, and I was by his side from dawn to dusk every day. And I remember we walked into one room, and there were people sobbing and desperate to listen to him and racing up and just clutching at him, and all of them were Chinese individuals. And I suddenly thought, well, maybe this thinking of how you actually can achieve your goals step by step, person by person, trying to encourage a transformation in each individual, though it takes hundreds of years probably, is a much wiser one than precipitating violence, which will only, as Gandhi said, an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind.
How much political power does he actually have? He's the head of state, but as I understand it, there's a government in exile, a prime minister.
There is, and at the minute or the year that he came into exile in 1960, he started drawing up a charter for a new democratic Tibet. Previously, Tibet had been very hierarchical. And then he even drew up a charter whereby the Dalai Lama could be impeached. So he's always been pushing his people towards democracy, and they are the rare peoples who are saying, no, please, will you take care of us and make all our decisions for us? You're absolutely right. There is an independent, democratically elected government, but the fact of the matter is that for Tibetans, he's not just a spiritual leader and not just a political leader, but in fact, they see him as the incarnation of a god of compassion. So even though they do have a prime minister and a government there, in reality, they will only listen to him. And so even when he speaks about going into semi-retirement and stepping down from his political position, alas, I think he'll never be able to do that, because the one Tibetan that every other Tibetan will listen to is the Dalai Lama, and probably will be the Dalai Lama through the end of his lifetime.
Let's get Jim on the line. Jim with us from Tallahassee in Florida.
Hi. I wanted to ask if Mr. Iyer could explain the spiritual succession of the Dalai Lama, whether the Dalai Lama has to pass away before he can be reincarnated. And I've heard stories of children being kidnapped because they were either saints or had some importance to the Tibetan people.
That's a wonderful question. And traditionally, when the Dalai Lama leaves, or leaves the world, when he dies, he leaves various signs, and one or two, and a search party of monks scatters around Tibet and conducts an intensive series of tests, narrows the group down to two or three young boys who may have been born at the right time and who fit the clues that the departed Dalai Lama left, puts them through more tests, and then comes upon a new Dalai Lama. But of course, that won't be possible now. And you're absolutely right. The second highest incarnation in the Tibetan system is the Panchen Lama, who traditionally has been the person responsible in part for choosing the next Dalai Lama. And when the previous Panchen Lama died about 18 years ago, the Dalai Lama found a little boy in Tibet, and he said, "This is a new Panchen Lama." But the Chinese authorities put that boy into house arrest and came up with their own candidate and said, well, this is, they chose more or less a puppet whose parents were members of the Communist Party, and said, this is the new Panchen Lama, and of course there's nothing anyone can do about that. So the Dalai Lama, this current one, has been very careful in laying the foundations for how a new Dalai Lama will arrive, probably outside Tibet, and probably in some unorthodox way upon his death. And for almost 40 years now, he said that the definition of a 15th Dalai Lama, the next Dalai Lama, is somebody who continues the work of this Dalai Lama. And what he's doing is preempting what he fears will happen, which is the Chinese will find some amenable boy and say, this is the Dalai, this is the 15th Dalai Lama. No Tibetan would listen to him, but they would in some ways hijack the whole process. So I think he's spent a lot of time for four decades now working out how perhaps to make an entirely new succession system whereby he could all but appoint a successor in exile whom the Tibetans would listen to and who would still serve as a unifying presence for them.
Yet doesn't that risk the problem of if there's an unusual, unorthodox method of choosing the next Dalai Lama, that person would lack the legitimacy?
It does, and I mean, it's a great challenge for him. I think his people trust him so much that if he were to offer a firm message to them, saying, please put your trust in this person, they would do so, and they would realize that unorthodox conditions make for unorthodox answers. He's sometimes said there may be no new Dalai Lama, or the next Dalai Lama may be a woman. He's open, I think, to any possibility, but certainly all of this is only going to put great strain on the Tibetan diaspora. And I think what leads to a certain wistfulness among many watchers of the situation now is that the current Dalai Lama is really the person who's most forgiving towards China and most in a position to come to a peaceable agreement with them. So it's in the interests of the Chinese to talk to this Dalai Lama, because whoever comes after him won't have that experience and may not take a position of such forbearance.
Jim, thanks very much for the call. That's one way to think of it, Pico Iyer. There's another way to think of it. We've got this guy, and well, we're just going to have to, there's nothing we can do. We're going to have to wait him out. But after him, the situation is going to get better. Either we may be able to hijack this process and have our own Dalai Lama, or a puppet, as you say, or even if there is one that arises outside the country that will lack legitimacy, all we have to do, we Chinese here in Beijing, is wait.
Yes, and they have indeed been playing for time, and for many years now, and just assuming that once he's gone, all the legitimacy and power of the Tibetan cause will disappear. And of course, he, as in a complicated chess game, has been trying to come up with his own answers. Among them, opening his doors to Chinese individuals and trying to make them the spokesman for the Tibetan situation.
And it also raises a question about these upcoming Beijing Olympic Games, as you and others have suggested. Yes, the protests arose at least in part from the opportunity they have at this moment to grab the attention of the world. But what happens next September when the Games are over?
It's so interesting you say that, because what the Dalai Lama has stressed from the outset is the only important thing is what happens after the games, when the attention of the world goes elsewhere and we start thinking perhaps about the presidential election here, and then China can do whatever it wants with the Tibetans and in Tibet, and very few people will notice. So I think he's constantly trying to find some safeguard for his people when the world is looking elsewhere, as it has been for most of the time. But it's interesting that he is, again, the rare Tibetan not to call for boycott, because I think he believes that dialogue and communication is really the only way you could come to a peaceful solution. And I was thinking about it as I was coming to the studio today, and thinking how we in the US, for example, have been on the receiving end of a terrible terrorist act earlier in this century. And the result of that is that I think we're much more hostile to radical Islam than if they had suggested a conversation. And I use that as just a small way of thinking that any time you bring violence against another party, it only hardens the differences and then escalates into more and more violence. That communication is the only way of breaking that cycle, because young Tibetans do speak about small terrorist acts that wouldn't be taking the lives of Chinese, but they would blow up Chinese power stations or perhaps that train or perhaps a road link in China. But I think the more they do that, the more China, which is not notable for its mildness in response, will demonize them and make things much worse. And the Dalai Lama often stresses that, as I think I mentioned before, the one thing that the Tibetan cause has is that it's practicing nonviolence. That's what separates it from every other group speaking or calling out for its freedom around the globe.
Boycotting the Olympic Games, that's nonviolent.
It is nonviolent, but that would isolate China, I think. And I think any one of us in our own lives knows that if, let's say, we organize a party tonight and nobody comes, that's only going to make us feel more angry towards everyone who doesn't come and towards whoever precipitated the boycott of our party. And I don't think that's going to lead to warm feelings on our part or any motive on our part to try to come to an agreement with the people that we disagree with. I think the only way is to keep the doors open of communication.
Our guest, Pico Iyer, author of The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Catherine on the line. Catherine with us from Vancouver in Washington.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for having me. I had a question for Mr. Iyer about, is there someone within the Chinese government who would be open to hearing these appeals from His Holiness, from the Dalai Lama, or whether, I mean, is there anyone who would be on his side or at least be open to hearing from him?
Such a good question. And I think he's counting on the fact that there are, even though we may not know who those people are, and even though they're all kind of cocooned and barricaded behind walls, and so it's very difficult for us outsiders to know what's going on within the Chinese leadership. But in the 1980s, the last time these kind of demonstrations came up, there were at least two Chinese leaders very close to the top of the hierarchy, Hu Yaobang and Zhao Jiang, who seemed quite responsive to Tibet. Hu Yaobang, I think, actually went to Tibet and acknowledged that mistakes had been made. And I think the Dalai Lama and the Tibetan community really hoped that he might do something, but then he got purged in an unrelated matter, and so suddenly the air went out of their balloon. But I think they're always convinced that no leadership is 100% of one accord, and that the more Chinese leaders are aware of what's happening in Tibet, the greater the possibility is that one of them would speak out on behalf of Tibetans. And just the fact that prominent Chinese individuals are doing so reflects, I think, something that's going on in the entire nation. The last time I was in Tibet, what struck me more than anything was that Chinese individuals I met were just as engaging and warm-hearted as the Tibetans I met. They had no grievance against the Tibetans. I think across the whole of China, most of the individuals are somewhat distrustful of their government, and although they can't necessarily say it, feel sympathy because they know that the deprivation of freedoms in Tibet reflects deprivations of freedoms in their own lives.
Catherine, thanks very much. Let's see if we can get one last call in. This is Amar. Amar with us from Yuma, Arizona.
Mr. Pequire, I have been following your writings for more than 30 years and, of course, followed the life of Dalai Lama. My question has always been Dalai Lama. I've admired him tremendously. He's a great spiritual man. But as a politician, he says that he follows Gandhi. Gandhi was an activist. I don't find any activism in Dalai Lama. For example, the Beijing Olympics is the time to be more proactive. And if you're not going to call for a boycott of this Olympics, I don't know what other such opportunity is going to arise if he is not going to take this opportunity. Like Gandhi did the Dandi March and the Quit India Movement. We haven't seen any proactive action by the Dalai Lama.
And I'm afraid I can give you just a few seconds to answer that, Pico Iyer.
The main difference is that I think during Gandhi's time, his population far outnumbered the British population, and that the one advantage he had was numbers. And I think that's one reason why the Dalai Lama has taken his claws globally, because within Tibet he has 6 million up against 1.2 billion, but within the world at large he has 5 billion against 1.2 billion. And I think that's why he feels that those of us elsewhere around the world will be the people who are helping in the nonviolent resistance of Chinese oppression, the way Indian individuals helped Gandhi and rallied around him.
Amar, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And thanks to Pico Iyer, his book, The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama. And he wrote the cover story for Time magazine about the Dalai Lama and protests in Tibet over Chinese rule. He joined us today from the studios of Sports Byline in San Francisco. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Neil.
Up next, Earth Hour 08 came and went on Saturday night. If everybody turned out the lights for an hour, would it really help stop global warming? Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.